so you're depressed. You've got no means to support your family suddenly. You head down to the local tavern for a drink to wash away your problems, if only for a little while. But as you're sitting there, enjoying a nice lukewarm, probably awful beverage, a press gang bursts in suddenly and starts rounding up anyone sitting around, including you. You're marched down to the docks, where you're told you've been hired as a seaman aboard some naval merchant ship.
Welcome to Meridians.
Hello, and welcome to Meridians. I'm Charlie Noble. Today we're going to talk about London during the reign of Charles II. Specifically, I'm going to cover the period from 1649 to approximately 1667 when the Treaty of Breda was signed. I'm doing something unique today. I'm going to break down the three different perspectives from the same time period. So first we'll look at King Charles II himself, as he navigated a pretty difficult reign. He's certainly not the worst king I've come across, considering what he had to deal with. He was beset with some serious challenges. Then I'll take a look at the merchant class and how they would have been affected by the events of this period as well. And also we'll take a look at the commoners of London and try to get a little bit more personal look at what have been like during this time. Now, there's so much that happens during this time period that I'm going to focus on some certain aspects that kind of stand out during this period. It was just a wild time for London and England in general, really, and I'm just excited to get into it. So here's the summary of events first, and then we'll kind of go into each class's experience. So King Charles I was sympathetic to Catholicism and was Anglican by birth. And this created a rift between the Anglican sort of Catholic sects and the more Puritan of what we call more be like Protestant and, you know, Lutherans, Presbyterians, the Puritan side. They just broke off from the Catholic Church. And this caused a civil war in England that culminated in 1649. We don't go into the Civil War too much because that'd be a whole episode itself. But King Charles himself, the first, would be out of power, the Commonwealth would be formed, and then King Charles would also be executed. So, kind of a big deal for England at this time. So, for a few years, Parliament was kind of in chaos, trying to figure things out. But then this Oliver Cromwell rises up. He would step in as Lord Protector of England and sort of restore order. And then Charles II, who was actually the heir to the throne, King Charles I's son, he would attempt to fight for his rule, but he was soon forced into exile in France. To some degree, Cromwell restored some of the religious freedoms that the Puritans had been fighting for, but this would only lead to the oppression of the other faiths and sects. So it's kind of like the other side kind of got their way for a while. So the Commonwealth would be short-lived, but it would have a lasting impact. Cromwell would have, he would conquer and unite Ireland, Scotland, and England under one single elected British Parliament and introduce a written constitution. They also formed a large standing army during this time, and this was a time for people to just kind of try. I mean, they've been in the Civil War for a while now. I think it was over 10 years. It was a dreadful war. I mean, everybody that died, obviously, was pretty much English, Irish and Scottish, so it's just an awful time, and I think they were probably ready to just have some order and just get away from the chaos during that civil war. But then Cromwell dies in 1658. Parliament is leaderless, and it becomes kind of chaotic again. They just, you know, they don't know what's going to happen, where are things going to go. It's so chaotic that Charles II is called back to retain his monarchy after some pleading and negotiations on both sides. But Parliament was reset back before the Commonwealth, and England was suddenly back to being a monarchy in 1660. So they had about 9 years of being under this Lord Protector who really wasn't a king, but in all, it kind of seems like he served basically as one. But much of Charles II's early acts would involve slowly rolling back the puritanical influence placed on these people. Instead, it would be replaced slowly by more Anglicans, Anglican-leaning laws. So here we go. Now it's leaning back towards the Anglican side again, stripping Puritans of their rights to worship as they chose. And these acts were known as the Clarendon Code, and they would have a profound impact. At one point, over 2,000 clergy members were ejected from service because they did not conform to the monarchy's new Anglican perspective. As for war, the Commonwealth didn't actually waste any time. In 1652, trade disputes would erupt between England and the Netherlands. The English seized 140 Dutch ships over new trade rules, and then a war broke out known as the First Anglo-Dutch War. They would come to an agreement to end hostilities in 1654, but the conflict between the English and the Dutch was far from over. In 1664, 10 years later, things would heat up again when the British made a show of force in New Amsterdam. They just showed up with a large force, and the city wasn't really defended, and it was given up by the Dutch. And actually, the entire colony of New Netherlands was given up and taken over by the British. And this would be what is now known as New York. And that's how the British got it. They just walked in and took it from the Dutch. And then, of course, the American people themselves took it from the Brits, so haha. But the Brits didn't get away with just taking this colony. They had a... Sure, they had shored up some of their shortcomings in naval warfare since the First War, because they hadn't fared really well in that first encounter with the Dutch. But now things would get even worse for Britain, actually. In June of 1666, a great naval battle known as the 4 Days Battle would commence. The Dutch only lost 7 ships with a few thousand casualties, but the British lost over 5,000 men and 20 ships. Kind of a big loss for them. Both sides kind of claimed victory, but really they both kind of came out worse off, didn't they? So the next year, an even worse tragedy, specifically for the British Navy, occurred. The Dutch sailed up the River Medway and attacked the poorly defended fleet at Chatham Dockyard. They burned several major ships, as well as capturing the HMS Royal Charles, which was the flagship of the English fleet. Ouch. That feels like a British version of Pearl Harbor, sort of, you know, although maybe not at the same scale of devastation, but it's a pretty big deal. They're really caught with their pants down. And this defeat would contribute greatly to the Treaty of Breda, which was signed in July 31st, 1667. England would retain ownership of New York, but the Dutch secured trading rights, and the English control over the seas was eased as well. They couldn't just bully the Dutch around on the ocean anymore. And if the war wasn't enough during this time, London would see other problems. The plague hit the city and killed as many as 100,000 people, which was about 15 to 20% of the city's population. Charles II and his court fled London in 1665. It got so bad. First, they went to Hampton Court, but then eventually went to Oxford to escape this plague. This put a financial strain on the monarchy's already strained budget. Charles would take the plague seriously, though. He made proclamations and orders to combat the plague spread. But then a year later, something devastating in a different way would happen. The Great Fire of London, 1666. So at 1 p.m. on September 2nd, 1666, London would experience the worst fire in its history. The ember from the oven of a baker named Thomas Farriner would spill out of the oven and catch some kindling on fire. Then the floor was on fire. The Farriner family escaped through an upstairs window onto a neighbor's roof and began to alarm the entire neighborhood. These were narrow, jagged streets. The houses, they were really close together. Worse yet, they were construction practices known as jettying at the time. And this is where the floor above the lower floor would jet out a little bit. And it's sort of like this like stair step outwards, larger and larger. So that you've got this, when you're standing in the street, you look up, you see the second floor is hanging over the first floor. And then the third floor is hanging even farther. So all this heat and fire is going right up into these wooden buildings and everything easily catches fire. The whole neighborhood caught fire pretty quickly. The fire got so out of control, so fast, it would consume 13,000 homes and 87 churches, and it burned for 4 days. It absolutely devastated London. Much of the city had been destroyed. It displaced 70,000 to 80,000 people, meaning nearly 80% of the people were now homeless. Could you imagine being that Farriner family that caused this fire? I'm not really sure what happened to them, but whew, I would get the hell out of London if I was them. A census taken 7 years after the fire indicated that 25% of the population left after this fire and never returned. Okay, now for each class of people, those were kind of the events. Now let's talk about sort of the experience of the different classes. And we'll start with the royals. And then we'll go to the merchant class and then the poor class. And we'll cover what it was like for each of these dealing with these conflicts. So to recap, we had the formation of the Commonwealth, the switch back to monarchy after the Commonwealth, the rolling back of religious freedoms. Then there was the plague. Then there was the fire. And throughout this whole period, there was war. And it sounds like a really shitty time for anyone living in London, or really England, but I'm starting to understand why so many colonists had risked their families' lives to just leave London, leave England. So let's talk about the king in exile, while Cromwell was Lord Protector back in England. We'll talk more about him from the perspective of other classes, Cromwell. But for Charles II's perspective, being in exile was an embarrassing way to start your reign. His exile lasted about 9 years. After he did try to fight for his rule, but he was defeated in Worcester in 1651. So Charles fled to France, where his mother was living. He ran to mommy. Yeah, that's kind of embarrassing. He lived in France for a time, but then diplomatic tensions would cause him to move to Cologne and then later Bruges. And throughout this whole time, Charles is trying to restore himself to the throne, talking to lesser monarchs and trying to get some support. He finally makes a deal in 1656 with Spain, sort of, in which he agreed to support their war against France in exchange for assistance in restoring him to the English throne. This gets Charles some traction, and the royalist army that had fled with him would then work with the Spanish army to win back control of England. At the Battle of the Dunes in 1658, Charles' forces gathered with the Spanish to fight the Anglo-French alliance, but they were defeated. Then Cromwell, you know, after this defeat, you know, Charles II's like, well, shit, what am I going to do now? But then Cromwell dies back in England. Oliver Cromwell dies. And this creates political instability once again. Enough that it scares Parliament, and they sort of invite Charles back to rule again. And this marked it. There was a little more to it than that, and we'll probably get into it a little bit, but this marked the beginning of Charles II's restoration period. Now, finally ruling England, Scotland, and Ireland as king, Charles II would hold court. And apparently, his court was one of the most lively, hedonistic courts in much of England's history. This gets to kind of the title of the show, you know, the Merry Monarch. Charles II became known as the Merry Monarch due to the way his court behaved. And it's kind of the context of the time, too. When he was in exile, he was forced to live in a way that was sort of informal for a king. So, you know, customs and things that, you know, there's certain ways that a king or a royal behaves. And he was forced to kind of live outside of those norms. And then after he's restored, much of that informality kind of leaked into his court. You know, it was kind of inevitable. That was his culture now. A lot of the people that were in exile with him would have been in his court. So there would be these lavish parties. They'd have music, poets, artists, and plays. And there were also many, 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 many rumors of sexual escapades on behalf of the king as well as the rest of the court. Apparently, he had many mistresses and was very active with women. But the public spectacles and the parties seem to have actually endeared Charles II to much of the nobility and the commoners as well. Charles was careful with the policies and the restoration of the Church of England, which bent their views back towards his more traditional and Catholic sympathizing views. After all, he needed to be careful. His father's heavily Catholic and Anglo-influenced views had contributed to his death, so Charles knew he had to be careful in the way that he proceeded. So he would change things over time with a series of laws known as the Clarendon Code, which I mentioned up front. There was a Corporation Act of 1661, which would also require all individuals holding municipal office to take Anglican communion. Then there was the Act of Uniformity. These are all part of the Clarendon Code. The Act of Uniformity in 1662 required all ministers to use the Book of Common Prayer for public prayers and sacraments. It also mandated how clergy would be ordained. Then in 1664, the Conventicle Act prohibited gatherings of more than five people for worship. And this might be the one you've heard of when you hear about Puritans moving over to the States, or North America, I should say, moving to the colonies. That's certainly one I remember from the school history books, is they talked about, well, these gatherings of people, and they couldn't have religious gatherings, so they decided to move. It was a little more complicated than that. See how he's slowly dismantling the religious freedom of all these people? It just kind of feels a little familiar to some sentiments in the U.S. right now. But anyway. So then there was the 5 Mile Act of 1665, which prohibited expelled clergymen from living within 5 miles of any corporate town or parish where they had previously served. That just sounds like some kind of sentence a pedophile would get, which, considering they're clergymen, makes me laugh. But anyway, so Charles is going about all of this, and he's getting some resistance. And there's a great deal of nonconformists and dissenters. But then something kind of happens that kind of puts all that aside. The plague hits. Charles orders ships to quarantine for 30 days to prevent the spread of this plague. So they've got to sit in the docks and they can't enter the city or unload anything for 40 days, 30 to 40 days. I think it started as 30 days and I believe it changed to 40 as time went on because it just, you know, the policy wasn't quite working well enough. So they make it even more harsh. So then travel restrictions are made. Doesn't all this shit sound familiar? I think we're all a little jaded about plague talk. Red crosses were painted on the doors of homes with the plague, meaning that the households had to quarantine for up to 40 days. And then Charles ordered special hospitals just for plague victims to be built. So, you know, he's trying to isolate these plague victims. Remember, they don't know shit about germ theory back then. They just have a vague idea that it's spread from person to person through contact of some kind. And, you know, his response seems like it was pretty decent from the sound of it. He was being proactive. And there was one other bright spot for, well, other bright spot. There was one bright spot for Charles in 1665. You know, he took control of New Amsterdam. And, you know, he was hoping to cement control of North America. But, of course, this kind of caused the Second Anglo-Dutch War to begin. Maybe not the greatest move. But then the plague continued to ravage the city, though Charles and his court, you know, his circus, whatever you want to call it, they eventually went to Oxford for several months. So he'd be away from London for, it seems like, about almost half a year. But Parliament even postponed and met up in Oxford as well. They had to flee the city. So it wasn't just Charles. It was pretty proactive. You do need your government to work, and you don't want them to, you know, it's not like a captain going down with the ship. You need people in charge to make rules and help end the plague. And it seems like he did a fairly decent job from what I have read. Comparing it to contemporary things and what we know about the spread of disease nowadays. But anyway, later that fall, the plague deaths started to decline. So by December, the number of deaths from the plagues kind of just drops dramatically. So maybe their policies or just immunity, chance, whatever it is. But Charles still waits until February of 1666 to return to London. But then he does, and he begins to govern again. Things start to kind of get normal. So the plague starts to die down, no pun intended. But the war with the Dutch was kind of heating up. The 4 Days battle would happen in June, and the British forces would lose 5,000 men. I mean, Jesus, they just lost how many people to this plague? Tons of people. And this would severely shake this loss. It was a loss. They claimed victory, but it was a loss. It would severely shake the confidence in Charles' leadership. But he doesn't get much time to contemplate his new military strategy and what he should do to react to this. The Great Fire breaks out at the beginning of September and rages for those 4 days. Again, Charles shows that he has an acumen for crisis management, though. He personally visited the affected areas. He even made the presence of... He wouldn't have had to travel too far to visit the affected areas, by the way. The affected areas were heading towards him pretty quickly, I'm sure. But he even had the presence of mind to tell authorities to demolish buildings to create firebreaks to prevent the spread. And this would be somewhat thwarted, though, by the local authorities, like the mayor of London at the time, Sir Thomas Bludworth, who sounds like a villain, but he was just indecisive in his actions, just kind of, I don't know what to do about the fire, and then the fire just kept spreading because he's an idiot. And so the fire grew much farther than it probably should have. If they'd have put fire breaks in early, the crisis probably would have been much less. But, you know, hindsight, 2020, blah, blah, blah. Eventually, though, Charles deployed troops to assist in creating fire breaks and also to maintain order during the absolute chaos that the fire had to cause. Charles' brother James, who was the Duke of York at the time, was noted for having a significant role in coordinating efforts to combat the fire. So good job, old James. We'll probably be talking about him more in this next episode, by the way. Charles would give speeches during this time, praise the courage of the people during the fire. It had to be a very trying emotional time for everybody. Jesus. Imagine if you were like 50 years old. You'd been through a civil war. Your king was kicked out of the country. Your king came back to the country. You probably fought in one of these wars. Then the plague hits. Then the whole damn city's on fire. It's just a tough time to be an Englishman and a Londoner. But, Charles would give these speeches, and he would express his vision for a more beautiful city to be built with safer materials. Like, you see what I mean? He's not the worst king you could have. If you're going to have a king, at least he isn't some just complete glutton who just sat around and just watched the city burn while he just toiled away in his castle, not knowing what to do. At least he got out there and tried to do something. As far as monarchs go, he seems okay. But after this fire, Charles would support plans for better urban planning as well, and, ways to prevent fires, wider streets, and restrictions on building materials. You know, kind of some obvious pragmatic approaches. I don't want to deal with this shit again in my reign. That'd be terrible. So he's, making good moves there. So after the fire's put out, Charles gets back to his war, of course, which he gets another awful blow, unfortunately, with that raid on Medway happens. And, they lose their flagship. Did they just call it a flagship? We lost our flagship. Or did they say, we lost our flagship ship? We'll say they lost their flagship, along with several other important vessels, you know. So he would order the mobilization of the militia to surround London after this, which, you know, London probably looked like it had already been attacked due to the rebuilding projects being underway at that time. So then this is when the British forces, you know, they make some concessions and the Treaty of Breda is signed. And England sort of gets the shitty end of the stick, sort of. That's the king's perspective in this time period, you know. So now let's look at what it was like for the merchant class. So now let's reset the timeline back to 1651. The country had been through civil war throughout the 1640s and would finally sort of have power consolidated with Oliver Cromwell in 1651. You know, they went through some chaos and got rid of their monarch, and, you know, now they just have this Lord Protector. I don't really see what the difference is. So now mercantilism took hold in England through a system of policies that were aimed at strengthening the economy of the nation. These are some kind of early concepts of nationalism, really, where the focus for a group of people is to support their own nation and not specifically to support one particular monarch or another. And these are new ideas that are really in their infancy, and it would take centuries to replace this concept of nationalism from replacing the sort of monarchy idea. It's weird to even think about from the perspective of the 20th century, 21st century, where, you know, this idea of nations is always, it's been around for centuries, it feels like, and, you know, but really it was centered around the monarchy back then. And so this mercantilism was a bit of a start in this sort of more nationalistic approach, I guess. So with these new policies, the country would look to secure trade routes and maximize exports over imports. This was achieved through various acts that restricted foreign ships from participating in English trade and would promote English shipping. And so, you know, if you're a merchant who's selling goods, you're going to need to work with trading companies a lot. You've got raw products that you need, and you've got finished products that you need to see sold. So these merchants were constantly at the mercy of these traders, as well as the shifting regulatory environment, which seems to be changing constantly. It's, you know, you want stability in your trade, right? You don't want to suddenly have, where'd our monarch go? Oh yeah, we killed him. Now we got this, we got a couple years of chaos. Then we have Oliver Cromwell takes over. What's next? So these trade companies would become very powerful eventually, but their power was just starting to grow in the 1650s as they were navigating these new rules and regulations. However, these companies would end up getting monopoly rights on trade routes, which would really, really give them a lot of power over time. This made them the vehicle of wealth for England, really. The British East India Company would start focusing on Indian textiles, particularly cotton and silk, and make a great deal of money that way. They would compete greatly with these Dutch and Portuguese traders. And then, of course, this is partly why the first Anglo-Dutch War breaks out, is over trade and control over navigation of the seas and who's shipping what. So this would cause disruptions and make trade difficult for both sides with this war kicking off. The English had many successes in the First War. They were never fully able to blockade the Dutch, though. So trade competition would just continue. The Dutch would lose 1,500 merchant vessels during this conflict, this first Anglo-Dutch War. But the Dutch also had a superior system of free trade that would prove better than the English policies, which England was all about monopoly and just dominate everything. And so then the Dutch were more of a like, well, we'll just have this free trade policy, you know, more modern. It feels a little more modern to more like contemporary trade policies now, where you can trade across the globe. So while the war ended in 1654, the problems with the Dutch would persist. In 1660, the Navigation Act was established by King Charles II, and this act ensured trade from English colonies could only be conducted on English ships, whereby so it monopolized colonial trade for English merchants, which is kind of not good if you're a merchant in the colonies, because now you had to find an English ship to ship your goods. You couldn't say, well, how much is it for the English ship? It costs that much. How much for the Dutch ship? Well, I guess it doesn't matter because I can't use them, even if they are cheaper to ship with. And if you tried to, you could get in trouble, blah, blah, blah. So then these merchants, they'd get this victory when, you know, their trading options did open up when the colonies were, when New Amsterdam in particular was taken by the British and rebranded as New York. So this would open up this whole new market for these British merchants. But one thing you need to sell, to be able to sell things as a merchant or a tradesperson, is you need people. But the plague broke out, and as a merchant, you know, setting aside the major loss of human life, the plague would be, it'd just be terrible for business, right? Imagine I just got a shipment of cotton in port. I've got a large order to fill at my textile mill, but suddenly my goods are trapped in a ship in a port in quarantine. So I don't have any raw materials. Oh, and then my foreman tells me that dozens of our workers in our textile mill are sick or dying and cannot leave their houses by order of the king because they've got plague in their houses. So many pragmatic and scared merchants, they just simply left London for their own personal safety. If you were a poorer merchant, you didn't probably have this option. You were stuck in London. However, the scarcity of goods in the city could turn you from a poor merchant to a wealthy merchant if you were lucky and could charge more for your basic goods. This, of course, would be counteracted by the fact that your market in London was dying, as everybody was dying from the plague. So then this great fire would sort of wipe the slate clean, but many merchants, they would be left homeless themselves with their businesses and goods destroyed by the fire. So you have widespread unemployment and homelessness. They were just the norm suddenly. Now, as a former business owner, you might have found yourself forced out of the merchant class entirely and forced to work as a commoner or a laborer to help rebuild. Your station in life could have been permanently reduced. But the restoration and rebuilding would come. In February of 1667, Parliament passed the Act for the Rebuilding of the City of London. This was kind of a remarkable undertaking. It would be very practical as a person at the time to just write off London and give up, which many did, fleeing to other parts of the country, as well as across the Atlantic to the colonies, where business was still booming. Without the support of the colonies, you kind of wonder, though, if London could have ever been, if they would have been able to bounce back so well without these colonies to support them and draw wealth from, and materials, more importantly. But, you know, they did have these colonies, and they began to rebuild. Buildings would now be mandated, of course, to be built from brick, and that meant, you know, more work for traders and merchants. And just workers in general. You know, if you've got large building projects, it's always good for business. So a new city, a fresh start. During the repairs to the city, temporary trading spaces were allocated to merchants. Imagine if you built furniture. Imagine if you made glass or traded fabrics. So many new houses going up. And there are so much stuff. There's so much stuff that needs to be sold. So many things that need to be bought. Wealthy merchants would have probably been made much wealthier. Many would become money lenders during this phase, this time of rebuilding, loaning money to the city at low interest rates. You know, so they're just sitting back and counting their interest as the city is rebuilding. The fire actually had a lot of benefits from an efficiency standpoint. You know, the wider streets made it safer for merchants and more efficient to move goods around. The city also suddenly became more modern overnight. To visitors, everything would have been seen as exciting and new, creating this environment, you know, it's like a vibrant environment for trade, this fresh new city. You know, a lot of people would be attracted to that. Okay, so now let's take a look at how things were for the poor common folk of the city. The Commonwealth was an interesting time in London if you were a commoner. No one living in the city had known a time when they didn't live under a monarch. It would be akin to having been married all of your life and then suddenly finding that you're out on your own. Sort of, anyway. I mean, Oliver Cromwell would be the Lord Protector by 1651, and it would sort of be a pseudo-king thing, but with the help of Parliament governing things, which had a lot more power after the Civil War. But the Commonwealth was politically dominated by the Puritans, who had come out on top during the Civil War. Puritans, being Puritans, would then begin to suppress any acts considered immoral. Theaters were considered immoral, and they were shut down all across the city. Certain public celebrations were canceled for the same reasons. Suddenly you were compelled into the Puritan way of life, whether you liked it or not. Religious attendance and adherence to the Puritan principles became an important aspect of life. It sounds incredibly dull, to be honest. To add to this, taxes were high to pay for military campaigns with Scotland and Ireland. So yay, now you don't have any entertainment, and now you don't have any money either. Great. But the other side of it was that corruption in the legal system was reduced because of the new policies by this Commonwealth. Instead of giving judges, I think they were given like paid per trial, sort of given like commission, but instead now they had fixed salaries. So they weren't incentivized to just, you know, guilty, 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 give me some money, give me some money. You know, that was pretty stupid system back then, before this. The Commonwealth would see a proliferation of workshops and warehouses, and during this Commonwealth time, bringing in more opportunities for work. But the work was hard, the pollution was bad, and if you weren't a Puritan, you were not a very happy camper. But then Oliver Cromwell suddenly dies in 1658. A power vacuum emerges. The Parliament becomes chaotic, and England becomes difficult to govern. George Monk, the Governor General in Scotland, sees this chaos start to unfold, and he would march his army, the largest in the Commonwealth, to London. There he would restore the Parliament that had existed at the beginning of the Civil War and bring King Charles back, King Charles II, and restore him back to power. And there wasn't a whole lot of resistance for this because they really didn't have any alternative plan figured out. So Charles II would then erode these Puritan, he would erode this Puritan dominance pretty quickly. Being Anglican, he was now suddenly the best thing you could be. You know, Puritans would soon see their rights eroded year after year with the Clarendon Code, but the theaters would open up again. The king would have lavish parties and celebrations. He made England great again. Okay, well, you know, anyway. So it's a bit of a topsy-turvy time. Now, as a commoner and being a man, you need to be careful. This was true during the Commonwealth, too, as it was during the Restoration. If you didn't have a job if you weren't already in the Navy, you were likely to, if you were caught standing around or, you know, not doing anything, they found you at a bar, you could be pressed into being in the Navy or being a sailor in a merchant vessel. And by pressed, I mean forced. So imagine this. You're a poor commoner. You've got a wife and kids, you know. You kiss them on the cheeks when you leave in the morning. She takes care of the kids at home, and then you head off to work in a warehouse. But you get there, and your job's been cut. They tell you they don't have any work for you. So you're depressed. You've got no means to support your family suddenly. You head down to the local tavern for a drink to wash away your problems, if only for a little while. But as you're sitting there, enjoying a nice lukewarm, probably awful beverage, a press gang bursts in suddenly and starts rounding up anyone sitting around, including you. You're marched down to the docks, where you're told you've been hired as a seaman aboard some naval merchant ship. Sailors were in great need, and if you had experience, that would be great, and if you didn't, still great. They didn't care, they just needed somebody on the boat. You are a warm body, and the Navy needed you. They couldn't let you go home to collect your belongings, even. If they lost track of you, you could run, and they couldn't have that. They've been through all that before. They're not letting you run around, go talk to your wife, and then they got to deal with your wife. No, they're taking you straight to the dock. You're getting on the boat. Maybe somebody will be able to send word to your family. Maybe not. Maybe she gets a letter from you in a week later informing her that, oh, sorry, I've been sent off to war, and I'll have a little bit of money here and there, but, you know, I can't do shit about it. So no goodbye, possibly no plan for return. It just sounds like a nightmare for any family. And this was normal back then. This was very normal for a long time. So now you're fighting in a war you've probably barely understand. You know, maybe you're not in a merchant. If you're a merchant vessel, maybe you aren't fighting in a war. But if you're on a naval vessel, now you're suddenly being forced into a war you probably don't understand. And you've got this ever-shifting power under your feet. This type of pressing, though, this naval pressing, it went on. It happened for a long time. And it wouldn't be until after the Napoleonic Wars in around the beginning of the 1800s that it actually ended. So now in our hypothetical story, let's say you were pressed in 16, let's put some timeline to it. Let's say you were pressed as a naval soldier in early 1665. While at sea, you hear that the plague is broken out in the city. Everyone on board the ship fears for their loved ones. You know, the mood is pretty damn sour pretty quick. I would imagine as a captain, you might even limit the information because it's not going to do anybody any good to know. But the plague would be dreadfully, it had to be feared by sailors. Aboard a ship isolated at sea, the plague could mean a death sentence for the whole crew. Then when you returned ashore, you were stuck in quarantine for another 40 days on the dock, waiting, hoping that your family was safe. Maybe they are standing there on the docks or standing, you know, up on the pavement looking back at you, and you're, you know, 200 feet away from each other. You haven't seen each other in 6 months, but you can't get off the damn boat. But, you know, maybe they find out, you find out your family's okay that way. But then you find out, you know, shoot, half of your friends are sick or dying, but you're still stuck on this boat, giving whatever money you can, you know, whatever you've earned. They did give them some money, but you're trying to support your family. But back at sea, they send you back, of course, but then you're back to war. Misery's just chasing you wherever you go. Maybe a cannonball shot kills one of your friends on board. Another friend dies of scurvy. You lose a few toes from an infection and walk funny from a piece of metal that was embedded in your thigh during battle. Then finally, at the end of 1666, you return to London to find it in flames. Your home, your entire neighborhood you grew up in, has been burned to the ground. But you find your wife. Miraculously, your children and her are alive. The city's started to be rebuilt, and you can feel this sort of sense of rejuvenation all around you. As an Anglican, maybe you've found some new sense of hope with the restoration of your values. You've got a growing sense of national and civic pride, and you work together with your fellow countrymen to begin to rebuild. And that is the episode for this week. Next week, we will continue from here. We're going to do the same sort of pattern. We'll cover the events, and then we'll try, you know, give the classes a little bit of a, you know, what the slice of life kind of thing, what it was like for them. But it's going to get, I'm going to try to make it a little more personal, a little more, I want to get into a little bit more of the day-to-day life. What did people do in London? What were their customs? You know, how did they go about, you know, what water did they drink? How did they cook food? You know, some of that stuff is kind of interesting. We'll try to get into a little bit more of their daily life to try and see what it really really was like to be a Londoner in that time. Maybe a little less focus on the monarchy, I don't know. You know, you get so much talk about kings and monarchs and he's in control and then this happened and they're in control. There's going to be some of that in the next episode because it was kind of a big deal, because we're going to basically go from 1667 up until the Glorious Revolution, which is I think is the mid 1680s. I haven't started writing or researching too much on that yet, but then I think after that, I am fairly confident that the show is going to, we'll find a link to a British colony, not North America, because we've just been there, but it should be fun. I'm thinking somewhere south of Europe even. But it should be a good time. I hope you join me for next week's episode. I hope you liked this little bit of a divergence from the sort of biographical narrative that we've done for two episodes with Benjamin Franklin. I don't want this to just be a biography show where we go from one person's life to another person's life. I think it's interesting to look at what life was like for a particular place in time, and, you know, just try and vary it up a little bit so it's not so dull. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. This has been Meridians. I'm Charlie Noble. Don't die of plague or light your entire city on fire, and have a good week.